From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, comedy. This month, Jay Leno is celebrating his fifth anniversary as the host of The Tonight Show. Getting there wasn't easy. We'll hear from Leno about his years as a struggling comic, doing stand-up in strip joints and sleeping on the steps of comedy clubs. Mike Myers wrote and stars in the new movie, Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. We'll hear a 1990 interview from the days when he was the youngest cast member of Saturday Night Live. We also have a 1990 interview with George Carlin. He has a new book called Brain Droppings. And TV critic David Bianculli comments on the latest development in laugh tracks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Zaire's president, Mobutu Sese Seko, has stepped aside today after dominating the country for over three decades. Zaire's information minister says Mobutu stepped down and left the capital city. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is in Kinshasa. She says Mobutu still retains the title of president, though.
The prime minister now is effectively in control. He specified that an Archbishop Monsengwo, who's head of the parliament, would now take up the task of negotiating between rebels and the government. The spokesman insisted that President Mobutu is in Zaire, though some diplomats doubt that. He did not comment on reports that he is headed into exile, but it's pretty clear that Mobutu is no longer effectively the president of Zaire.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden. The announcement that Mobutu has given up power comes as rebel forces draw closer to the capital. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says Mobutu's departure clears the way for a peaceful resolution of the conflict in the country. President Clinton is praising the agreement on details of a budget balancing plan, and he's calling on Congress to enact the proposal as soon as possible. Late yesterday, the White House and GOP congressional leaders resolved a number of technical disputes that were stalling the deal. The House Budget Committee has begun considering the outline of the agreement today. Chairman John Kasich says the budget plan will reduce the size of government and give the American people more power. A racetrack building being demolished north of Miami collapsed today, killing two workers and injuring three. Rhonda Barnett is with the Metro Dade Fire and Rescue Service.
We don't expect there to be any more people in the rubble. The construction foreman has indicated that everyone is accounted for. We don't anticipate finding anyone else. In fact, the scene is now officially a homicide scene. We have terminated the search and rescue effort.
Barnett says the building was part of the historic Biscayne Kennel Club, one of the nation's oldest dog tracks. The shuttle Atlantis is closing the gap with the Russian space station Mir. The two spacecraft are scheduled to link up tonight, and more than just the astronauts will be watching. For member station WMFE, Pat Duggins reports.
An experiment on the space shuttle will try to use navigation satellites to track Atlantis and Mir on the final approach. U.S. troops use these same global positioning satellites during Operation Desert Storm to determine their location on the ground. Sensors on both the shuttle and Mir will use the GPS system to track each other as they sail around the Earth at 17,000 miles per hour. Once the mission is over, scientists on the ground will compare the satellite readings to Atlantis' own radar to check the accuracy. During the actual docking, the astronauts will depend on handheld laser rangefinders to track Mir. Once the vehicles are just a few feet apart, astronaut commander Charlie Precourt will use a TV camera mounted in the shuttle's docking tunnel to zero in on an X-shaped target mounted on Mir. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
And you're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market has fallen from its record highs in heavy trading. The Dow Industrial Average is currently down about 39 points. A major technology firm is leading the way down, as Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Today's decline is being led by computer system stocks, which weakened after Hewlett-Packard released disappointing earnings. Investors are also expressing anxiety about the possibility of the Fed raising interest rates next Tuesday. The outlook for rate policy was muddied by this morning's report on April housing starts. Overall, housing construction increased by a stronger-than-expected 2.6%, but that was mainly due to a sharp rise in the volatile area of apartment building. Construction of single-family homes barely rose, while permits for new work declined. Meantime, the University of Michigan reported an increase in consumer sentiment during May. I'm Doug Krisner.
Russia has completed its biggest foreign investment deal ever, a contract for construction of a $2 billion oil pipeline from western Kazakhstan to the Black Sea. Chevron is the largest single shareholder in the consortium backing the venture. Construction on the pipeline is scheduled to start sometime early next year. Nissan says it has developed a hybrid electric car that combines the benefits of both electric and gasoline-powered vehicles. The car has both an electric motor and a gasoline engine, which powers a generator to produce electricity. As a result, the car can be driven without charging the batteries from an external power source. Nissan says the car will have twice the range of a conventional gas-powered car with dramatically reduced exhaust emissions. Nissan hopes to market the car by the end of next year. Earlier this spring, Toyota announced the development of a similar hybrid car. I'm Craig Windham.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Like just about every young comic of his generation, Jay Leno's early dream was a guest spot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. A lot of Leno's friends got their chance before he did, but he's the only one who finally inherited the show. Next Thursday, Leno celebrates his fifth anniversary as the host with a special show featuring some of the funniest moments since he inherited the program. Leno's memoir was published late last year with lots of funny stories about his family and his years on the road playing bars, strip joints, and comedy clubs. His memoir, Leading with My Chin, also came out in CD form, featuring Leno reading from his book. Before we hear the interview we recorded last October, let's hear a reading from his CD.
I'm a half-breed of the oddest sort, one part Scottish, one part Italian. The combination makes no sense because each side couldn't be more diametrically opposed. My mother, Catherine, was born in Scotland, and my dad, Angelo, was a first-generation Italian-American. And I seem to be divided right down the middle. My Scottish side, practical, analytical, even a bit frugal. The Italian side, loud, outgoing, ready to laugh and be laughed at. Of course, my mother never really understood the Italian part of my behavior. When I was a boy, she would all scold me, "There's a time to be serious and a time to be funny." But in truth, there was never a time to be funny. We could be at Disneyland. My mom would say, "Not now! Not now, Mom. When am I supposed to be funny? We're at Disneyland. Seems like it's always time to be serious." She would later watch me do my stand-up comedy and make little notes. I'd ask how she'd like the show, and she would say, why can't you sing a little song and do a little dance? Nobody likes jokes all the time. Nobody wants someone to be funny all the time. The most entertaining spectacle in my youth was to watch both sides of my family try to interact. Each side obviously had totally different attitudes and approaches to life. At the Italian functions on my father's side, there would be hundreds of meatballs for maybe eight people. More food than anyone could possibly eat. Huge pots, huge portions. My mother's sister, Aunt Nettie, would be incensed by this. "Look at the food, Jamie. The food that's going to waste. The waste!" If there were more than two lights burning in any room, she'd scream, "I can't believe it. All these lights, the waste of electricity, Jamie, the waste!"
Jay Leno, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The passage that we just heard had to do with your parents, and I really love the way you talk about your parents. You really express the frustration that you had with them, but you obviously loved them so much.
Well, yeah, I had great parents. I mean, most comics, you know, again, I'm sorry they weren't incestuous or drinking or beat me or anything, so I don't have any excuse. Most comics that I've read about or met always seem to have these horrible childhoods, and the comedy come out of this horrible pain, which is legitimate, certainly. It just didn't work that way for me. For me, the humor was always the fact that my parents were in their 40s when I was born. And besides my mom being an immigrant from Scotland, my mom being Italian, the differences were so horrific.
Your dad being Italian?
Yeah, were just hilarious to me. I mean, I'll never forget, you know, in that sort of teenage rebellion thing. I remember I was in the eighth grade when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And, you know, I said, "Hey, Dad, the Beatles are going to be on." You know, my father, Beatles or whatever that is, you know. And so anyway, the Beatles come on and they're singing, "Yeah, yeah, whatever, doesn't want to hold your hand." And I see my dad with the newspaper in front of his face, you know, deliberately not watching, you know. And I just said to him, I said, "You know, Dad, you know, the Beatles write all their own music." And my father just puts the paper down. He says, "Let me tell you something. You know, some manager gives these kids a couple of bucks to go out on a stage and act loony, and you kids all fall for it." And, you know, I couldn't even argue with that. It was so ridiculous. That was my father's whole explanation for the Beatles' career. Some guy gives them a couple of bucks, and they go out, and they act loony.
When you were starting in comedy, there uh-huh. weren't comedy clubs yet, not as we know them. Some of the venues that you played included retirement homes, prisons, mental hospitals. This is through a state program in Massachusetts where yeah. I think you got like $10.
We used to get $10 a show to do old people's birthday parties for yeah. the state. We used to do prisons. I did a show at like Walpole State Prison. And prisoners are not a good audience, you know, because comedy is based on a certain civility. Hi, folks. How are you? You know, and when you got a guy sitting in the front row and he's got a little blonde kid on a choke chain wearing underpants sitting on the floor next to him, that's not an ideal audience, you know.
What material would you do in your
prison?
Just
do your regular act. I only had my act growing up, whatever. You know, I used to do these psychiatric homes and they get like, you know, and this is not to make fun of psychiatric patients, but, you know, you go there, hi, everybody, how you doing? And then, like, in the middle of your act, there'd be a guy in the corner going, ah! Ah! And then orderlies would come in. And this would just break the mood of the whole room, you know. Say, anybody here from Boston? Ah! Ah! You know, hey, calm down there, fella. How you doing? You know.
Well, did this give you confidence performing in front of people?
Well, it was fascinating yeah. because you realized, it wasn't until I performed at, like, this place called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston that I ever got a professional audience. You know, I could always say in my own mind, well, you know, the audience, it's a psychiatric hospital. They didn't laugh because there's obviously something wrong with them.
Well, you can say, right, they don't laugh. You They're know, crazy.
Yeah, it was like strip clubs.
Yeah.
When I would play strip clubs, they wouldn't laugh or applaud or do anything. But it gave you the confidence just to stand on stage because the people weren't paying any attention to me anyway. I mean, there's a story in the book about playing this club called the Mineshaft, where it was in Minnesota. People would pay $5 to get in, and then for another $5, the customers would get a miner's hat with a light on it. Now, there were no lights in the club. It was just a big, empty building. And the women would come out and dance, and, of course, the guys had the lights on their heads, and they would look at whatever part of the woman they wanted to look at with the light, and I would just be standing in the darkness. Telling jokes. Hi, everybody. How you doing? Occasionally, somebody would look over at me, and I couldn't even look at them because they had the bright light on their head. So if they looked at me, ow, it burned my eye. I had to look away. So most of the time, for the whole week, I was just standing in darkness while guys looked at these women with those miners' hats on.
When you moved to Los Angeles, you moved there before you had a home, before you had any money, and you often ended up just like sleeping on the steps of the comedy clubs or sleeping in the alleys
yeah,
by the comedy clubs.
I used to get picked up in L.A. for vagrancy. And what the cops would do is they just put you in the back of the car and you just drive around with them on their shift all night. And being a comic, you know, this worked, well, somewhat to my advantage, but actually, no. The first time I got picked up, you know, they'd say, yeah, let's move along. Where do you live? I don't kind of live anywhere. All right, get in the car. What do? I'm a comedian. Oh, yeah? Tell us a joke, you know. Then you'd sort of try and come up with every dirty joke you could think of to tell these cops all night. And har, har, that was Lila. And then that worked pretty good. I thought, well, they let me go. But then two or three nights would go by and the cops would go, hey, are you that comedian guys our partner picked up the other night? Yeah. You get in the car. Oh, those jokes you were telling. So, you know, two or three nights a week, I'd have to ride around until dawn telling jokes to different cops because they would say, hey, have you seen that kid on the street? Pick him up. He's got some funny jokes.
You were probably one of the most hardworking comics in show business when you were getting started, just performing anywhere and everywhere
yeah.
to get experience. But sometimes you get billed, you'd get booked in really inappropriate places. And my favorite story about that is when you were booked, I guess it was in a Catskill resort at a Hasidic, at an Orthodox Jewish resort.
Yeah, there was
and
this.
You were booked as what? Tonight, Jay Leno, Jewish storyteller.
I was billed as a Jewish storyteller.
What did you do?
This agent in New York would come into the clubs and he'd say, I need a comic this Saturday, pays $50, you know. And I remember one time, before I get that story, this guy sent me up to a job and it paid $100 for the weekend. And I thought, well, that's pretty good, $100 for the weekend. And I remember afterwards, the owner of the hotel came over and said, boy, that was very good. You know, normally we don't like to spend $1,200 on an act, but we really enjoyed you. And I realized the agent took, you know, $1,100 commission out of my $100. You know, it's just a nightmare. Anyway, that was the last time I worked from him. And the first time, he sends me up to the Catskills at the L'Chaim Resort or something like this. And I said, what is it? It's just a nightclub. I said, what kind? I said, is it mostly? Oh, no. Go up there. So I finally find this place, and it's all these cabins way back in the woods. And nice people, but it's a Hasidic resort. And I pull in there, and it says on one of these, one of those bad signs that, you know, you pull on a trailer, and it's got the flashing lights around it. Tonight, Jay Leno, Jewish storyteller. And I go, so I get there, and I walk out on stage, and it's all Hasidic, you know, and I don't even speak Hebrew, or you know. And I said, listen, it's been a big mistake. You know, I'm not really a storyteller. I'm not even Jewish. The guy made a mistake. A lot of, and then this guy, so do your act. Let's see what you do, you know. So I did my, and they were very nice. And I mean, they were polite. You know, he just, you know, I felt bad for them, and they felt bad for me. And they were nice people. It just, it wasn't what they had bought, you know. You know, it was a horrible job.
You know, I think it's funny, in your book you talk about how when you were getting started in comedy, or maybe this was even before you got started, when you were growing up, that comics meant adult guys, usually from New York, usually Jewish, who spoke more to your father than they spoke to you.
That's true. When I was a kid, you had Alan King, you had Rodney Dangerfield, and these guys were always funny, but they always came from the point of view, at least to me, was these kids today with the long hair, you can't tell the boys from the girls, I tell you, you know, and all that was funny. My father would laugh at that. And then I remember seeing Robert Klein and George Carlin and David Brenner and Steinberg, and these guys would come out. And suddenly I noticed I was laughing more than my dad, because their humor was coming more from my point of view, especially Robert Klein. He was a guy who was, I felt, like me, middle class, normal parents, not crazy, not rich, not poor, just normal. You know, watched the same TV shows as the kid that I watched. Joked about the same kind of things that I watch. And that was a big change in comedy, at least for me.
So how did you figure out where your material was going to be?
I figured it out from watching those guys. You know, I said to myself, boy, these guys make fun of the same kind of things that I think are funny. These are the same things I talk about with my friends. I mean, prior to them, I don't think you would have seen Alan King come on the Ed Sullivan show and do jokes about Jimi Hendrix. You know, it just didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen.
No, it would be about Jimi Hendrix mowing his lawn.
Right. Jimi Hendrix with a hair like that, you know. But, I mean, suddenly here were guys on mainstream television talking about things only kids, you know. Now adults buy Rolling Stone albums, you know what I'm saying? But
back in
the 70s, there were adult records, you know, which you had Henry Mancini and Frank Sinatra. And then you had, for the kids, you know, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, whatever. And nobody ever did jokes about the Beatles on mainstream television. These were the first comedians to sort of parody younger people's lifestyles.
My guest is Jay Leno. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jay Leno. Like most young comics, your ambition when you were starting out was to eventually get onto The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
What was the most memorable part of your first shot on The Tonight Show?
Most memorable would be, I got heckled my first shot, which was a horrible experience. But luckily, I'd worked a lot of clubs, so I could deal with that. And Johnny seemed to like that. But our producer, who is still with NBC in The Tonight Show to this day, Fred DeCordova, you know, he would say to you, okay, here's the deal. He would come over and he would say, and Fred was somewhat of a legendary figure, having, you know, directed Jack Benny and all these people. He would say, after you do your stand-up routine, if I go like this, waving my hands towards me, that means come over and sit down to Johnny. If I put my hand up like this, stay on your mark. If I wave you away, go behind the curtain. But whatever you do, don't move until you get my signal. I said, yes, sir. I walk out, I do my routine, thank you, good night, big laughs, Hannah, thank you very much. I look over and I see Fred about to signal me, and his phone rings. And I see him, hello? And now he's talking, and I don't know what to do. And the audience is now getting into that, you know, down to that odd one or two claps. And I'm still standing there, so the applause picks up a little bit more, as if people are going, oh, all right, just get lost, will you, you know. And I'm going, hi, and he's talking away, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. Now the applause has all but stopped. Fred puts the phone down. He looks over, completely forgetting. Oh, come here. Come on. Oh, thank you. You know, I realize it was only maybe 6-7 seconds. But, of course, to me, I might as well have been out there an hour and a half at this point, just hanging, waiting to get Fred's signal to come over and sit down next to Johnny. So that was pretty scary.
On your first shot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, mm-hmm. did he laugh at your jokes?
Yeah, he was very good, actually. He was a terrific audience. I mean, that's what The Tonight Show is. It's not trying to get the audience to laugh. It's trying to get Johnny to laugh.
Right.
But, you know, the
right.
audience gets the cue from the host.
Right.
And if Johnny is laughing, they're enjoying it more.
Did Johnny Carson give you advice about your stand-up act or later on about guest hosting or hosting when you took over?
Not so much about hosting, but he did about, you know, the first time I did The Tonight Show. Well, actually, I was a guy that was sort of the last of my graduating class to do The Tonight Show. By graduating class, I mean all the guys I sort of started with, Robin Williams and, Letterman and guys like George Miller and so many of the comics, they all did it before me. And, you know, Johnny came in one night at the Improv to see me. Harvey Korman brought him in. And, you know, there are two kind of comedians. There are comedians that have a lot of attitude and not many jokes. There are comedians that have a lot of jokes but not much stage persona. By attitude, I mean those kind of comics can get on stage and go, "Hey, pal, nice hat. All right, what did you win? Like, somebody guess your weight?" You know, that kind of thing. And they're loud and they're boisterous and they're just funny in their nature, but there are no jokes. And then there are other comedians like, you take a guy like Stephen Wright, who are just natural joke writers. You know, very monotone. They tell the joke a certain way. And to me, the best comedians are the ones that combine both those elements. You have a joke and you have an attitude. I remember Johnny came to see me and he said, you know, he thought I was funny, but I wasn't ready for the show because my jokes were too far apart. You know, I didn't quite understand what he meant, but I listened. And then I started watching his monologue, and I realized, you know, he was doing 15 or 20 jokes in a space where I was doing 5. I mean, I could get on stage and being sort of physically big and loud and imposing, I could get a laugh where there wasn't any. But that was great for a nightclub, but not for TV. You know, the idea being on television, if the joke doesn't work, your funny attitude will carry you through. And if your funny attitude doesn't carry you through, your joke will carry you through. And if they both work, you got a killer joke, you know?
Now, how do you work up your opening monologue?
How?
Well, and how do you feel, and also how do you feel about having writers writing with you? I'm sure during the years that you were doing clubs, you were writing all your own material. And I
was writing all my own stuff, and there's this arrogance that a lot of comedians had, and I certainly have it. Or at least had it. You know, well, I can do this. I can handle it. I mean, you know, it's a bit, comedians tend to be like Democratic presidents. They think they can handle the whole thing themselves. You know, you know, I always said the Republicans elect stupid presidents and brilliant staffs, and Democrats elect brilliant presidents and stupid staffs. And it's the same thing. Comedians are like that. They come in and they say, I can handle it. Like the first 15 to 20 times I hosted The Tonight Show, I said, I don't need cue cards. I'll memorize it. And I did okay, but then I realized this is ridiculous. If you're going to do this every day, you can't memorize, you know, 11 and a half minutes worth of jokes. I mean, you'll go nuts. You'll go crazy trying to do this. And then I gradually got into it. And now the way it works is, we tape the show from 5 to 6. Then we have a meeting. I go home at maybe 7:30, 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock, I start to put the monologue together. 11 o'clock, Jimmy Brogan. He's the guy working on the monologue. We go through maybe 500 or 600 jokes that we've prepared that day, or everybody's prepared. And they're not all jokes. Some are just punchlines. Some are just setups. Some are, did you hear about the guy who did this odd thing in Iowa? We try to make a joke out of that. Sometimes it's a complete joke from a writer. Anyway, we'll try and put at least half the monologue together by 2 or 3 in the morning. And then I get into work about 8:30 and through the course of the day, and you're writing jokes constantly as you're picking the red M&Ms out of some rock group's, you know, dressing room, because whatever, you know, you're still dealing with show business people. You know.
You're kind of famous for hating vacations, for not liking to not work. You like to work a lot. Is that still true, that you still don't like vacations?
I'm not a vacation guy. You know, I was somewhat dyslexic as a kid, and I always remember my mom saying to me, well, you're just going to have to work that much harder than the other kids to get the same thing. I never thought I was insecure. I just thought I was being lazy. And that may sound silly, but to me, if something didn't work, it didn't work because I wasn't working hard enough. Like when the whole thing with The Tonight Show was going on, is Jay going to be replaced? Is he going to get fired? They're going to replace him with Letterman. Well, obviously 16 hours a day is not enough. Maybe I need to do 18 hours a day. And it worked, you know. I mean, that's what works for me. You know, I never said I was the best. I never said I was the funniest. I just said I will work at this harder than anybody else. Like if I take a, you know, I went to Hawaii once. This was like a nightmare. I was doing a gig in Hawaii and I had to stay down there like 3 days. And the second day I'm sitting on the beach and I look at my watch, 10 o'clock. I'm sitting on the beach about 4 hours and I look at my watch and it's 10:30. I go, great, my watch broke. The battery's dead. And then I asked them, what time is it? And they said, it's 10:30. And I said, really? I've only been sitting here for half an hour? I thought it was like 2 o'clock. This is like a nightmare. Get me out of here. And I'm not a vacation guy.
It must be strange for you, knowing so many comics so well and having been in the position of being a young, hardworking comic really wanting their big break, to now be the guy who could give a young, hardworking comic
a
big
break. Oh, man, it's a nightmare.
And I'm sure you don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. On the other hand, you want to have the best show you possibly can. So it's probably a really awkward spot.
No, it's horrible because I used to think, well, now that I'm hosting The Tonight Show, I can go anywhere. But now you can't go anywhere because you walk in and you go, oh, gee, there's Larry. I got to hide. You know, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, you know, you have friends that come up to you that, you know, it's when I first got the job, men, women, comedians would come up to me and they go, hey, Jay, you know, Johnny would never put me on, but now you got the show. It'll be great, man. I can come on all the time. And I'd have to say, but, you know, if you weren't good enough to get on with Johnny, it's not good enough to get on with me. You got to make it funnier. And, you know, I lost a lot of friends that way. I mean, it's just there are people that I love dearly as friends, but the material is not strong enough, or maybe it's really old-fashioned, you know? It's just, you know, old jokes about, I don't know, hippies or airline food or whatever it is. And you just say, you know, you got to update the stuff. And they just don't get it.
Jay Leno, recorded last October after the publication of his memoir, Leading With My Chin. Next Thursday, he celebrates his 5th anniversary as the host of The Tonight Show with a special program featuring some of the funniest moments since he took over. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mike Myers is starring in the new comedy Austin Powers. Coming up from the archives, an interview from his Saturday Night Live era. Also, George Carlin on the 7 dirty words he wasn't supposed to say on radio or TV. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at the latest annoying development in laugh tracks.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mike Myers wrote and stars in Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery, the new movie comedy that spoofs James Bond thrillers and mod fashions of the 60s. From the archives, we have an interview I recorded with Myers in 1990 when he was the newest and youngest cast member on Saturday Night Live. He was already well known for his character Dieter, the pretentious host of Sprockets, a postmodern culture show on West German TV. And he was best known for Wayne's World, the sketches in which he and Dana Carvey played the loud, obnoxious teenaged hosts of a cable TV access show. They later expanded the sketches into a couple of movies. I asked Mike Myers to describe his character, Wayne.
Wayne is a compilation or a distillation of everybody I knew growing up in the suburbs of Toronto. It's a sort of adolescent, suburban, heavy metal experience. And so I thought, what if my character Wayne, who I did at Second City in Toronto and Second City in Chicago, had his own cable access show? Hopefully it would be how I was when I was a kid, which is, God, it would be great to have my own show in my basement. And then I'd have anybody I wanted on to be on. And it's completely, it makes no attempts to be universal. It's just totally about his basement and his world.
All right, welcome to Wayne's World. Here's your host, Wayne Campbell.
Party! Woo! Party hardy! Woo! It's Friday, it's 10:30, it's time to party. I'm your excellent host, Wayne Campbell. With me, as always, is Garth.
Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth. Okay, before we bring out our first guest, we'd like to introduce our newest feature. It's called Movie World with Wayne and Garth. Movie World! Let's take a look at the movies, all right? The first movie is Back to the Future 2, starring Michael J. Fox. I liked it, Garth.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Okay, let's move on.
Did you ever talk in the kind of teen slang that Wayne is always coming
up
with?
Yeah, I did. I went through a lot of adolescent phases. I went through a heavy metal phase, and then I went to England in 1977 just as punk was big. I went through a punk phase. Then I saw the movie Quadrophenia. Did you ever see that with
The
Who?
Yeah,
and I went through a mod phase. There's a ton of mods in Toronto. It would be like, you know, there'd be mod bars. People would actually go out and buy Vespas and stuff. And then I got hired at Second City. By that time, I just turned 19, so I was out of my adolescent thing. Although when I got hired at Second City, I had really short hair and a long tail down my back.
So do you keep your ears open for teenagers to hear what kind of language is? Because language changes so quickly.
Yeah, it does. But I'm surprised that it doesn't change all that much.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be an adolescent accent, which is weird, that people tend to grow out of or socialized out of. And I was surprised at how homogenous to North America it is.
Did you have it?
Yeah, it would be like, I don't know what you mean. Hey, back off. Don't hassle me, man. It would be like that. I really like that guy, you know? And it's strange, too, because people who are in the arts had the same type of accent in Toronto, too. It's just, I really like that painting. I really thought it was great. I like his use of negative space. You want a cappuccino? I really like it there.
This is the roots of Dieter, right?
Yes. Well, that's the thing. They're all related. It's all... tribe? It's tribes. You know,
I couldn't believe that there'd be any kind of link between Wayne and Dieter, but I guess you just.
Well, it was a friend of mine in Toronto who never actually got to be an artist, but did everything around art. Like, he was interested in photography, but he ended up painting backgrounds, you know, like the splotches of paint. And he was interested in being a filmmaker, but he got into colorizing and somehow managed to justify colorizing, even though it's sort of impolitic in the art world.
For our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, which features your character, Dieter, would you describe it for us?
Dieter was a young artist from Stuttgart who came to Toronto. He's an actual person.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, and he was a waiter in Toronto, and he would, like, take your order and say, what would you like? And then you would start to talk, and if it was a hot dog or something banal, he would say, your order has become tiresome. I'm going away now. And if his favorite tune came on, it would be like, yes, and would you like, hold on, my favorite song? And he would go up and dance. And then you'd wait for hours. But he was fascinated with obscure Americana, like F Troop and hockey cards. He loved hockey. That was our main thing that I thought I could talk to this person. Was he loved hockey, and I thought it was amazing. And he also loved to touch monkeys. And that's actually true, because he took a textures course in Stuttgart, and he had to touch tapioca, styrofoam, and monkeys. I love textures. Your eyebrows are bizarre. Can I touch them? You know, he'd say things like that.
Yeah, you have such a great way in that show of intellectualizing everything that's fun or pop or...
With Dieter.
With Dieter, yeah.
Any sort of pretentious or pseudo-pretentious idea I ever had, I can sort of stick it into Dieter, and Dieter can do it. And it's like, it's not me, it's this guy.
That was Vietnam by Schreibmaschine. And now's the time for Rater Record. What is your name?
My name is Gerhard Müller.
My name is Elsa Bauer.
And what gymnasium do you go to?
We go to the Goethe-Gymnasium in Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
Your hair is grotesque. What did you think of the song on a scale of 1 to 14?
It was hellish yet exquisite. I give it a 9 out of 14.
I thought it was bourgeois and banal. I give it a negative 3 out of 14, and I thought lyrically it had...
Your story has become tiresome. Sadly, there are no integers on this scale, so your gangly adolescent attempt to be clever has been futile.
Well then, Dieter, what did you think of the song?
It had a good beat and it was easy to dance to. I gave it a 14. This next song is called Darwin's Burden by the Obelisks.
How did you get on Saturday Night Live?
I worked at Second City in Toronto, and they had a 15th anniversary. And Pam Thomas, who is Dave Thomas's wife, who also used to cast on SCTV, Dave Thomas was on SCTV, called up Lorne Michaels and said, you've got to see this kid and whatever and all that stuff. And Martin Short was at the 15th anniversary and said, oh, I'll call as well if you like. And I said, sure, if you want. And so they called up, and it was really nice of him, and both of them called up Lorne Michaels, the producer of the show, and I went and had a meeting, and they looked at tape of stuff I did in Canadian TV, and then they hired me.
Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that you got signed by SCTV on high school graduation day?
No, well, not SCTV, Second City Theater Company.
Right, okay, in Toronto. Toronto.
Yeah, my was my last day of high school. My exam was at 9 o'clock. My audition for Second City was at 12 o'clock, and I was hired at 3 o'clock.
How did they know you? What did you do to get hired that young?
I'd done the workshop program when I was 18. I'd just turned 19, like 2 weeks before. And I did 2 sessions of it where I had to pay, and then I didn't have any money. And they said, well, just stick around. And so I did. And I auditioned actually once when I was 18, and then 3 weeks later again when I was 19, and then they hired me.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of characters did you do on Second City? Did you do character sketches?
Yeah. Toronto Second City is much more character-oriented than Chicago Second City. Chicago Second City tends to be more of the political theater, political satire mode. And Toronto is as well, only we don't have nearly the vibrant political scene that there is down here. So it tends to be more character-oriented, which is why SCTV... got the show and was character-based. Because, you know, it's... We don't have a debate about gun control. We have it. We don't have a debate about socialized medicine. We have it. We don't send foreign armies anywhere. We don't have an army to send like that. So the politics aren't as strong, you know, and as day-to-day. So we're more character-based.
So you developed Wayne's World for Second City.
Well, I did Wayne as a character. I did it in a sort of a mock Shakespearean Romeo and Juliet thing.
Oh.
Where, so I am to be banished, for I am from the Campbell clan. And then it just went on half Shakespeare and half not. And but the character I did on Canadian TV, I used to do a thing called Wayne's Power Minute on a show called It's Only Rock and Roll, where I would just do a minute on any topic that inspired me that day.
Did you go to college after getting signed to Second City right after high school?
No, I didn't. I was that day, strangely enough, that I got hired. Last day of high school, hired Second City. I go home, check the mail at 4 o'clock, and I was accepted to York University that day to study film. So it was like, here's all your options for the rest of your life. Now! So my plan was, if I didn't like Second City, I would use that money towards university. And I ended up really liking it, so I didn't go to university.
What were your plans if you studied film? Did you want to be a film critic
or a director?
I wanted to be
Francois Truffaut.
Uh-huh.
And Martin Scorsese and Fellini and more of the Dieter side of me. Well, also, too, I would like to have made films like Breaking Away and Strangelove. But I think ultimately my hero is Peter Sellers, and I think I would have been frustrated. It would have been a means of being able to perform in comedy.
You didn't have imaginary films that you shot in your bedroom or anything.
I made
like
Super
that,
8 films.
You did?
I did, yes, indeed.
What kinds of films?
Oh, real embarrassing stuff.
Hey, great, tell.
Yeah. I did a film about this guy who's a tortured punk because he had to live in the suburbs and be a punk rocker. And it was called Punk in Transit. It was so bad. I don't know why I'm telling you this. So it was very embarrassing.
You did commercials as a kid?
Yeah.
What kinds of commercials?
I used to actually have my resume memorized. It was like Kit Kat, Applejack, Sunlight, BC Hydro, Datsun, Kmart Shoes, Wrigley Spearmint Gum. Just anything where they needed a little red-headed kid. You know, gee, Mom, this is the best. That was me. And then I went through my punk phase, and I couldn't get cast for my life because I had really short hair and T-shirts that said Anarchy in the UK. And they wanted, like, a little kid who plays basketball. And I'd be like, yeah, forget it. Basketball's bourgeois. So I stopped doing that.
But so how old were you when you stopped?
My last commercial, I was 17, and I haven't done one since.
Well, that's pretty old, actually.
Yeah.
I just expected you were doing it for baby food or something when you were really young.
No, I started when I was 8, and I did a dancing commercial.
Oh, great.
For
with
Datsun.
Tap shoes and everything?
No, it was jazz dancing, which is even more a secret. Sort of dancing, solid gold type dancing that nobody really should see. And that's what I was doing.
Thus the corniest kind of dancing, the kind of interpretive dancing
no,
on
cornier.
Commercials. Yeah.
No, there's cornier dancing, and that's the reason I got into dancing was there was a show on Canadian TV called The Pig and Whistle, which was a mock pub show, British pub show,
uh-huh.
for British expatriates who were, like, really homesick. And it was like, come in to the Pig and Whistle, come in and have a laugh. And then they had these Cockney, like, Mary Poppins dancers, you know, with the kerchiefs tied around their neck
yeah.
and flat caps. And a lot of posing and a lot of knee slapping. Knees up, Mother Brown. Knees up, Mother Brown. And I thought, now I was 4, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever, to dance like the guys in Mary Poppins. And so I said, can I do that? And my mom said, sure. So I went to the dance people, like the choreographers of that show,
yeah.
and they also had a dance school. And that's where I got into commercials.
Come a long way, haven't
well,
you?
Well, I've come a long way since The Pig and Whistle.
So that's how you started doing commercials?
Yeah.
The name of the psychotic killer who escapes from the institution in Halloween is Michael Myers.
Yes.
Did you hear about this a lot when when the
yeah,
movie came
whenever
out?
I go to cash a check, it's Michael Myers, the killer. Just don't kill me. Honestly, I'll cash the check. And I have to give them one of those, that's funny, I never get that laughs. That's great, I never get that. That's great. And, no, we're completely different. He's the evil Michael Myers. I'm the good Michael Myers. I mean, while it's true I do own a mask made out of flesh, I wear it infrequently, and I've really never killed anyone, to my knowledge. So I think that's where the similarities end.
Mike Myers, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mike Myers recorded in 1990. He's now starring in the new movie Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. Coming up, George Carlin. This is Fresh Air. George Carlin is celebrating his 60th birthday with a new book called Brain Droppings and a new video called George's Best Stuff. Carlin is the comic who said the 7 dirty words you can't say on TV. He didn't say them on TV, but when he used them in a 1972 performance, he was arrested. And when the radio station WBAI played his recording of the monologue, it led to a major FCC decision which upheld restrictions on indecent language on the radio. George Carlin first became known as one of the most popular counterculture comics of the early 70s. I spoke to him in 1990 and asked him about his famous Seven Dirty Words routine.
Now, part of what this routine was about was the absurdity of banning words,
yes.
The absurdity of being
yeah.
so offended
one
by language.
One would think that would be protected speech.
And an example you gave was, and I can't give the full thing, but you said you can say, don't prick your finger, but if you reverse the order of those words, that would be considered obscene.
Right.
Did the judges in the various trials get the point, do you think?
Absolutely not. I don't think they even listened. I'm sure they didn't listen to the record to hear it in its fullest and best context. I'm sure they read portions of the transcript. It's in the interest, I guess, of the white male religious corporate paramilitary state that we live in to control us. And the FCC, of course, has control only over broadcast media. And I guess they found a way to interpret that form of expression differently from the printed word and the spoken word. The argument, which I think is specious, is that because this goes out into the home, that somehow it's going to injure someone morally if it comes through the speaker. They don't take into account the fact that there is an on-off switch on every radio and there is a station selector knob for changing the station. The man who made the complaint, one of these moral commandos, a professional moralist who wants us to live his way, sat in his car with his son and listened to the entire broadcast, and I assume they were not morally degraded in any way. I assume the child has developed in a normal way in spite of listening to that routine. So where is the argument? I don't follow the damage. I don't see where the damage occurs in this language being used.
You know, Lenny Bruce always said that when he was up on obscenity charges,
yeah.
that he wished he could perform the material for the judges, you
yeah.
know, because they were hearing, you know, either reading transcriptions or they were hearing people quote the material.
A cop was doing his act.
Oh, right, poorly. That's it. Yeah,
yeah.
And, you know, Bruce really felt, well, if they're going to get what it's about, they have to hear me do it. Did you
sure.
feel that way yourself?
Well, I feel that the thing was rigged to start with, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think the outcome was inevitable. But surely it would have been fairer to the process to listen to the recording. And the other thing about it is there was a warning given, there was a disclaimer given by the radio station saying that there'll be language on this next recording which you may find offensive. There was the point made that it was in the context of speaking about protected speech. And certainly there, in that case, that has to be a redeeming artistic feature, which is one of the tests for obscenity. Of course, they didn't test it for obscenity. They called it indecency and got around the obscenity law in that manner.
Now, you were arrested in Milwaukee in 1972. For...
Yeah, now that was more for public, what you call it, disorderly conduct. The concert was outdoors, and the speakers, the concert setting outdoors was in a larger setting of a festival, a summer fest.
Mm-hmm.
And so the complaint was made on the basis of the fact that the language coming from these speakers flowed out of the concert area into the area of the general public. And the policeman felt that was wrong. I think I think his idea was, he said, there were mothers listening to this, which I don't understand at all. But at any rate, we just waited, as the lawyer told me, he said, we're going to wait a few months on this case until a judge comes around who understands the First Amendment. And apparently in Milwaukee, that took about 6 months.
Did you expect to be arrested? Did you have
No.
any idea this was coming?
Oh, absolutely not. No, and I think it was a spur-of-the-moment decision on the part of one policeman.
And how did they come get you?
Oh, they just came backstage. My wife came out on stage during the show to warn me that they were back there. She came out ostensibly to bring me a glass of water, and it was a large kind of unruly audience and everything, so an interruption like that wasn't particularly damaging to the flow of the show or anything. So she just got me aside and said, there's police backstage and they're going to arrest you. So I went off stage a different way where they weren't waiting, and at that time I was still a user of illegal substances, and so I got rid of what I had on me so that the only arrest would be for this spoken violation and not for something else, which they would have loved to catch me doing.
George Carlin is my guest. How did you start using, quote, dirty words in your performances?
Well, I always felt that I didn't want to be denied a significant portion of the language, significant not numerically, but in terms of impact in speech. You know, I just felt that if I was forever going to avoid these words, that I was somewhat crippling my ability to express myself. I use those words in my private life. People I know do. They're valuable words for expression. They give spice and emphasis to language, and they in the sense of comedy monologues, they can be very useful in giving characters, enhancing characterizations, and giving emphasis to ideas. So I didn't want to be crippled by not having them available to me. See, like, my point is, a person like Bill Cosby is forever forbidden now to use those words publicly because people don't expect it of him. I wanted to have the choice. I think you're freer when you have a choice. I think to not use them would have made me a form of restricted speaker, and I didn't want that. So I just decided to use them so they'd always be available to me.
George Carlin, recorded in 1990. He's celebrating his 60th birthday with a new book called Brain Droppings and a new video called George's Best Stuff. Coming up, laugh tracks get worse. This is Fresh Air. TV critic David Bianculli has noticed yet another developmental step in the history of the TV laugh track, and to him it's no laughing matter.
As much as I love comedy, that's how much I hate laugh tracks. The only thing I hate worse than a laugh track on a funny show is a laugh track on an unfunny show. Or so I thought, until I found something I hate even more. More on that in a minute. But first, this quick history of the laugh track, and how and why it came to haunt TV in the first place. As far as I can tell, it's the fault of one guy, Ed Wynn. Most people think of Ed Wynn mainly as a vaudeville performer in the early 20th century, but he was also a media pioneer. In 1949, he starred in The Ed Wynn Show, the first TV series to come out of Hollywood. In 1956, he took another big gamble and played a dramatic role in a Playhouse 90 production that's still remembered as a true TV classic, Requiem for a Heavyweight. But earlier in his career, Ed Wynn was a radio pioneer, too. All the way back in 1922, just 2 years after the first radio station was established, Wynn starred in the medium's first stage show, a production of The Perfect Fool. He was so worried, though, about performing his comedy routines just for the radio microphones, he grabbed everyone who was within reach, secretaries, stagehands, even station executives, who were famous for their lack of sense of humor, and had them act as his studio audience. Because he was insecure, he secured his place in laugh track history. That was the first time studio laughter became part of the equation, and it's never left. On TV, there have been several phases of the laugh track, and each one has been less honest and more annoying than the one before it. First, there was the studio audience for a live program, the Ed Wynn type, only bigger. When you watched your show of shows in the early 50s, whatever laughter you heard was coming from real people who were laughing at the same things you were. Then came I Love Lucy, where the laughter was recorded, but still real. But slowly but surely, when less funny shows came along, TV invented the canned laugh track, where the sounds of people laughing at something else, something funnier, were inserted in post-production to make those jokes sound less awful. In the 70s, the feel-good Norman Lear sitcoms added a new wrinkle to laugh tracks, The sensitive ooh sounds, where studio audiences were heard to ooh and ah sympathetically to a warm episode-ending hug. Pretty soon, these too were recorded and dispensed freely all over the place, like bootleg tapes from a Grateful Dead concert. Married with Children was the next major development. For this show, the studio audience was encouraged to whoop and holler at every opportunity. Whenever Christina Applegate's sexy character of Kelly entered, wearing one of her micro miniskirts, the audience howled. Not as in laughter, as in coyote. But now there's a whole new deadly strain of laugh track out there. I found it on Pauly, that horrible Pauly Shore sitcom that's so bad, even Fox came to its senses and canceled it after just a few airings. But the damage has been done. Listen to this dialogue between Pauly and other characters, and pay particular attention to the sounds coming from the audience.
If you want, Becca, I got two words for you. Cyber sex. You see, Paul, interactive is the future. I can build you a virtual Becca right here.
Cyber sex is so low. It's so impersonal. Wow, are those 3D?
Downloading smut again. Hey, not so fast. Print me another naked Brad Pitt.
I couldn't place those sounds for a while, but I finally did. When anyone makes a juvenile remark on Pauly, which is almost all the time, the sound you hear from the audience is the sound of a bunch of preteens going down a roller coaster ride. It's a woo track, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if Disney and Universal were recording those screams at their respective theme parks, then selling them to Fox to use on their sitcoms. Pauly is gone. The woo track, though, is bound to return. Just watch and listen.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News and the author of The Dictionary of Teleliteracy. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Fred Snyder, Joyce Lieberman, and Chris Fraley. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a personal history of rap from the co-founder of the rap group that's been together longer than any other, Run DMC. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
2 years ago, a friend of mine asked me to say some MC rhyme. So I said this rhyme I'm about to say. The rhyme was there, but then it went this way. Took a test to become an MC. And Orange Crit became amazing.